beginning in verse 28 of Luke chapter 9, God's infallible, inerrant word. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. As he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen.
This study is one of a series that we've had going for a number of weeks on the glory of Christ. And this evening we'll be looking at another installment in that series. So we have three points to the study. If you like to follow along or take notes, it's from this passage. First of all, what we must see. Secondly, what we must avoid. And thirdly, what we must hear. So we'll be following that outline. First of all, what must we see? Verses 28 to 31. And we are to see the glory of Jesus, simply. As he was praying, his face was altered, verse 29. His clothing became dazzling white. And Moses and Elijah come, they are appearing in glory, and they're speaking of his departure. So we have the circumstance of this setting, and it's while Jesus was praying. He had gone up with three of his disciples up on the mountain. So in the midst of prayer, this all takes place. There's a change in verse 29. As he's praying, we have this, this described visually. The appearance of his face was altered. His clothing became dazzling white. And then there's a conversation, verses 30 and 31. Just a couple of comments here on the change in verse 29. Excuse me, I'm still getting over the flu. I'm not contagious, but Luke calls it the appearance of his face was altered. He's the only one that describes it like this. Matthew and Mark all use the word transfigured. He was transfigured before them. And it was not that he was changed into something that he was not. Rather, there was a revealing of who he really was. That's what this is. They begin to see him, a glimpse still, veiled still, yes. But this is the Son of God. So there's that change. There's a conversation with the two premier leaders of the people of God from the Old Testament, Moses and Elijah. Notice their conversation, you know, of what are they speaking. Verse 31, and they spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. His departure. It's the word Exodus. This is the grand, the ultimate Exodus event that will take place in Jerusalem. Not on the way, but in there. So that's their conversation. And, you know, what we might ask, what was the purpose or the function of this conversation? I think it's we could say at least twofold. One, it's an encouragement to Jesus. Donald MacLeod, in his book on the person of Christ, makes this point. He says, sometimes we subtly think or let the fully divine part or character of Jesus overshadow that he was also fully human at the same time. We assume this, the divine kind of overshadows the human to the point where we assume Jesus really did not ever have any needs at all. Well, that's not the case. What an encouragement here to him of his true identity, a reassurance of his divine splendor in the heavenlies, especially. Now, what is he facing now? Where is he headed? He's headed to Jerusalem, where that physical image will be disfigured and he will die. That's where he's going. With the coming abuse and the anticipated humiliation of the cross, he is reassured and encouraged. He's tried to mention it to his disciples already, but that's like talking to a brick wall. Verses 44 and 45, you know, Jesus tells them again. He says, let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. How did they respond? Oh, yeah, I get it now. No, but they did not understand this saying, and it was concealed from them so that they might not perceive it. Same thing will happen again later. So this event and talking with Moses and Elijah is an encouragement to Jesus, but it's also, it would be, an encouragement to the 12. They got a sneak preview of real glory. You know, he had already told them 8 days earlier, there in verse 22, he'd charged them, don't tell anybody else, but the Son of Man must suffer. It is of divine necessity that I must suffer many things, be rejected, be killed, be raised. Like water off a duck's back. They don't get it yet, but they would remember later on. You see, they too, with the coming events, they too needed an assurance on record that suffering was not diminishing his splendor. That the Roman crucifixion as a common criminal did not negate his regal glory. And the misery that he suffered, anguish unto death, did not cancel out his majesty. Not at all. Rather, the 12 would be stabilized. There would be something that settling to them, give them ballast in the stormy seas of those awful days. And for us, it's not so much what we see, but verbally what we hear, what the Word of God tells us. We need to see the glory of Jesus. Remember some years ago, I had an opportunity to work at what had been a vacated Monsanto plant on the Tennessee River up in North Alabama. And we were slinging Cooper tires, and working with a large group of ex-cons. And so after some months of working there, somebody called a plant meeting. And we went to the office area, and there were the plant manager, the foreman, all the employees, and remember it was a big business deal, more of information. We were just there to listen about changes that were coming, and I remember standing in the back, and one of the foremen pointed out somebody down front I did not know, hadn't seen him before. And he just nudged me and said, "You know who that is?" I said, "I have no clue." He said, "He owns everything in this place and writes your paycheck." I didn't know that. He was wearing a faded flannel shirt and faded jeans. But apparently, and I don't know the acreage that plant involved, but he had a piece of prime real estate on the Tennessee River in Guntersville, and he was a wealthy man. Now, you could have fooled me. He looked like just one of us. But the nudging by my foreman friend told me who he really was. The disciples needed to know who Jesus really was, to be reminded of it now. They had been told before. They needed to be reminded, especially with what's ahead for them shortly in the coming days in Jerusalem. First of all, we need to see the glory of Jesus. Notice with me, secondly, what we must avoid. Verse 32 and 33. Not surprisingly, it comes from Peter. Now, Peter, you know, they were asleep and they're fully awake. He saw the glory of Jesus, those two men. He said, "Master, it is good that we're here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." And then Luke adds this note, not knowing what he said. What must we avoid? We must avoid the folly of Jesus's servants. Notice the recognition and then the reaction. The recognition in verse 32. The three disciples had been heavy with sleep. Now they're fully awake. You know, they're not groggy. They're seeing what's going on. Their reaction, the reaction of Peter, his uninformed declaration is a mistake. It's a mistake. Indicated by Luke's comment, not knowing what he said. The problem, it seems, is what Peter wanted to do is to prolong that experience. Let's make these booths and linger here. Some people seem to think it was like a feast of the tabernacles. They would build temporary booths and stay there for some days. But this wasn't meant to be prolonged, you see. The intention was something temporary. What was meant to be temporary, Peter was trying to turn into an ongoing experience. Let's stay here. Continue in this. Don't let it change. Now, you know, some things are meant to be temporary. It's deliberate. It's planned. That's the intention. Much like for David Rice Atchison. Did you know that on one occasion, for one day, he was the 12th president of the United States? James K. Polk decided not to seek a second term. And so the Whig Party nominated General Zachary Taylor, and he easily won over his challenger. So the date was set for his, I started to say coronation, but that's not what we do here. He'd take the oath of office, but it was on March the 4th of 1849. It was a Sunday. Now, Taylor was a fairly staunch Episcopalian, and in the light of that, he was a strict Sabbatarian. Inauguration or not, he was not going to do it on Sunday. Well, we need to have a president. So they grabbed the president pro tem of the Senate, poor old David Rice Atchison, gave him the oath of office on Sunday, and he was president for a day. It was temporary. It was a temporary arrangement. It was intended that way. The oath of office, the larger ceremony was held the next day on Monday for Zachary Taylor. This situation on the Mount of Transfiguration was temporary. That was the intent. I wonder how often we want to make things permanent or as an ongoing experience, things that are meant to be temporary. For instance, what about you remember the date when you were converted? Many of us don't. Many of us were converted as covenant children and just don't know a day when you did not love Jesus and His people. Others have a date and time, a place. What if we wanted to prolong that date and time and place experience? Well, it's never intended that way, is it? We're to grow up and move on. Or perhaps we want to make an ongoing experience some season of rapid or special growth or special joy in the Lord. And we think, oh, if we could just go back and relive that and have it, you know, for the rest of our lives. Well, the Christian life is not designed that way. Those seasons come, yes, thank the Lord. But they come to an end and we have to go on. The Christian life is more than that. They're intended to be temporary, not as an ongoing experience. So what must we avoid? We must avoid the folly of Jesus' servants, His disciples, there on the Mount of Transfiguration. Thirdly, what must we hear? So we've seen what must we see? That is the glory of Jesus. What must we avoid? Well, it's what Peter was doing, the folly of Jesus' servants. Thirdly, what must we hear? We must hear Jesus' words. Verse 34 to 36. Notice again, as He was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them. They were afraid as they entered the cloud, and a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is My Son, My chosen one. Listen, listen to Him." And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. They kept silent and so forth. What must we hear? We must hear Jesus' word. Notice the divine declaration in verse 35, then the human response in verse 36. The divine declaration brings identity, a clarifying identity and direction. You know, it's interesting. Just 8 days ago, Peter had said, "You are the Christ of God, the Anointed One, the Messiah." Verse 20 of this chapter. Now they hear it, the voice of the Father. "This is My beloved Son, My chosen one." The identification. He calls the voice of the Father, calls Jesus My Son, My chosen one. Now, the language here emphasizes both the divine relationship and the divine choice. He is My Son. That's the relationship. He is chosen. Deliberate choice is going on here. Both of those in this identification mark Jesus out as different from and superior to Moses and Elijah. No one else like Jesus here in this scene. In the Bible, the language of chosen, choose, select, elect are often synonymous with beloved. Love before the foundation of the world. Now, with that in mind, it's interesting that the first time we hear a voice from heaven in the Gospel of Luke, or is at the baptism, the first time Jesus hears it, at the baptism, Luke 3, verse 22, the Holy Spirit descends on Jesus in bodily form like a dove. A voice from heaven says, "You are My beloved Son. with whom I am well pleased. Now at the transfiguration, this is my chosen one. Both are true. Beloved son, chosen one. If you are a Christian, you are beloved of God. Your Father loves you. And He selected you, elected you, He chose you before the foundation of the world. Deliberate act on His part. So it may be said of you, you are the chosen daughter, the chosen son of God. You are the beloved daughter, the beloved son of the living God. That was His identification, His identity. And then one directive comes there at the end of the verse. Into verse 35, listen to Him. Listen. The disciples did not realize the kind of Messiah Jesus intended to be. It seemed they still had hopes like the crowds. Here is the Son of David, our military leader. And He's going to overthrow these scoundrels, the Romans. Be triumph for all. Not at all. He was not that kind of Messiah. You see, genuine faith needs to be informed and shaped by the Bible. Don't be thinking that Jesus is someone He's not. Or that He's made promises to you that He hasn't. I remember years ago, a dark season in life, cutting all the lights off in my study and curling up in a corner and praying this. I did not think You were like that. Ever been there? We need to be very clear about the God to whom we belong and what He has said about what it means to be a son or daughter of the living God and what He promises on this earth and what He doesn't. But we need to be informed by this book. We need to listen. We need to hear Jesus's voice. We don't need to make Him out to be someone that He's not. Much like the baseball controversy between Johnny Pesky and Al Simmons back in the 40s and 50s. Johnny Pesky played for the Boston Red Sox. He was a shortstop, third baseman. And Al Simmons played for the Philadelphia Athletics. Now, the background to this was Johnny Pesky's name was John Pavescovich. So many syllables. Pavescovich. Okay? Try not to say that too often. All right? He came to America. He was from Croatia. Americans had so much trouble pronouncing his name, especially the loud, folks in the press box calling out who's up to bat and who's at what position. He said, look, I'm Johnny Pesky. I'm Johnny Pesky. That's it. That's enough. Okay. Just stop there. All right. Things were going all right with that until the Philadelphia Athletics were coming to town, and they had an outfielder by the name of Al Simmons. Now, that was not Al's real name, for Al had a background as well. I'll try to get his name right. His name was Alenchius Szymanski. Can you imagine? Alenchius Szymanski playing right field. No? Well, he had the same thing, and he said, look, I'm Polish, and let's just shorten it down to Al Simmons. Just call me Al. All right. Well, Al started writing letters to Johnny in preparation for their meeting on the baseball field. And they had some derogatory terms about background and family and all that sort of thing. Finally, Johnny said, look, I'm not any of those things. I know who I am. And I know where I am. I'm in America. I know Americans have trouble with multi-syllable last names. And I've shortened my name for my friends. But you don't define me. Even our misgivings of who Jesus is do not define him. That just causes us trouble. So what must we hear? We must hear Jesus' word. It's interesting, the reaction, human reaction of awed silence. And only Luke gives that detail. And it seems, you think about it, that's the only appropriate response to what has just happened, to what they've just seen, to what they've just experienced. Awed silence. But ongoing for them and for ourselves, we need to hear Jesus for us in his word by his Spirit. That's the one we need to hear.